Chapter 44. I Get Reelected. In my first campaign in 2008, I barely survived the year's nastiest, hardest-fought, most eventful, and exhausting Senate race, winning by the smallest margin in American history after an unprecedented 8-month recount and legal battle. In my second campaign in 2014, I ran against a friendly, very successful businessman who didn't know a lot about public policy, and I beat him by 10 points. It was a terrible year for Democrats, which everybody saw coming. For one thing, it was a midterm, and for whatever reason, we struggled to turn out voters in non-presidential election cycles. Meanwhile, the group of senators up for re-election included a lot of red and purple state Democrats who had been swept into office thanks to the Obama phenomenon, and of course, the stench from the dead, rotting corpse of the George W. Bush administration. That meant Mark Begich had to run for re-election in Alaska, as did Mark Udall in Colorado and Kay Hagan in North Carolina. They would all lose, and so would longtime Democratic incumbents Mark Pryor in Arkansas and Mary Landrieu in Louisiana. Meanwhile, open seats in Iowa, where Tom Harkin retired, and South Dakota, where Tim Johnson retired, and West Virginia, where Jay Rockefeller retired, and Montana, where Max Baucus had stepped down to become President Obama's ambassador to China, all flipped to the Republicans as well. For me, election night 2014 was pretty much the exact opposite experience from election night 2008. My race was called the moment the polls closed, and we all cheered. Then I spent the rest of the night watching all my friends give somber concession speeches. And instead of worrying that I'd screwed everything up for everyone, I kept getting asked what my secret was. How had I pulled off such a big win in such a down year? The weekend before the election, on Meet the Press, the political panel was discussing who ran the best and worst campaigns of the year. Chuck Todd had the answer. I have to give the award for best to Al Franken, because guess who we're not talking about today? Closest Senate election 6 years ago, Al Franken. Recount, all of those things. How did this guy survive? 6 years of a well-run campaign. You have to give that to him. A lot of the credit goes to Matt Burgess, who ran my re-election campaign, and the terrific staff he pulled together. In a year when a lot of Democrats were on their heels, our campaign focused on the work I'd done on things like reining in Wall Street abuse and made an aggressive argument for a more progressive economic policy, taking on hedge fund tax breaks and other elements of the rigged system. The reason we were able to run such a confident campaign, though, was that the people who worked in my Senate offices in D.C. and Minnesota had done such a great job. Led by Casey, my chief of staff, and Alana Peterson, who had been my state director ever since I took office, well, they made me look good every day, for which I have to remember to stop giving them credit. Chuck Todd was right, as he always is. I didn't win re-election because of what I did during the 2 years of the actual campaign. I won because of what I did during the five and a half years of my first term. It turns out that being a good senator, working hard, sweating the details of legislation, staying focused on the issues that matter to your state, looking for ways to find common ground with the other side even as you stand your ground on your core principles, is good politics. That's especially true when people initially had a lot of doubts about whether you'd be a good senator or even remotely competent. "You're better than I thought you'd be," a businessman in Bemidji told me early in my term. "Thanks for having low expectations," I replied. But there is something about barely winning an election that makes you take nothing for granted. And the fact is, I had started getting nervous the day after the 2012 election was over. I was officially in cycle. In the spring of 2013, I made a quick fundraising trip to Florida. And while getting on the plane from Miami to Minneapolis, I had a conversation that made me feel much better about my prospects. "Are you one of my senators?" the young woman asked as we waited on the jetway. "You're a Minnesotan," I replied. "Yeah," she said. Then I'm one of your senators. Why are you here? She asked. Fundraising. I'm running for re-election. She nodded. This November? No, next November. Oh, she said. Is Amy running then, too? No, she ran last year. She won by a big margin. Oh, well, I don't think you'll have any problem. Everyone says you work really hard. Wow, if that's what had filtered down to low-information voters, then I must be in good shape. Put that in your model, Nate Silver. Still, I didn't take my opponent lightly. Mike McFadden was a wealthy investment banker with a very telegenic family. One of his five sons, Connor, would always sit up front at our debates with a big grin plastered on his face, which I thought was intended to psych me out until I realized it was a reminder to his dad to smile, which was really endearing. It made me think of Franny sitting in the front row at my campaign rallies, frantically tugging her ear when she thought I had gone on too long and should wrap it up, which I never did. On paper, Mike was a strong candidate, a successful businessman, a Pop Warner football coach, a board member of a Jesuit high school for low-income minority kids, and a political novice who could credibly claim to be an outsider in a year when people were pretty sick of Washington insiders. Like, I guess, Mike would say, me. But one thing he had going against him was his name, McFadden. You see, before me, there was Norm Coleman, who's Jewish. Norm had succeeded Paul Wellstone, also a Jew. Paul had beaten Rudy Boschwitz, Jew. My campaign slogan? Minnesota isn't ready for a Gentile in the seat. At least that was my slogan at the Jewish Federation dinner. Mike made some rookie mistakes, such as telling a reporter that it would be fine with him if the Keystone Pipeline were made with Chinese steel. There's a reason Minnesota's Iron Range is called the Iron Range. Mike's comment didn't sit well with Rangers who had lost jobs to dumped Chinese steel. As someone who had once been a rookie myself, I felt just terrible watching him step in it like that. No, actually, I enjoyed the hell out of it. Given Mike's lack of familiarity with government and the nuances of campaigning and my own work on the granular details of public policy, there was every reason for me to be supremely confident about the upcoming debates. But for some reason, debate prep seemed more difficult than it had 6 years earlier. The format of 1.5-minute answers followed by 30-second rebuttals seemed so artificial to me, and my brain, now packed with material from hundreds of nightly briefing binders, I kept giving wonky, almost listless answers that wandered all over the place. The day before my first one-on-one debate with Mike, I got a call from President Obama. I'm sure he was calling around the country, checking in on all our 2014 Senate candidates, but it was a nice gesture. "How's it going?" the president asked. "Oh, good," I said. "I'm ahead by 10 or so." "Great. But you know, Mr. President, I got a debate tomorrow, and for some reason I'm really nervous." "Uh-huh," he responded, as if he knew exactly what I was talking about. "For some reason, I'm having a hard time learning my responses." "Is it because the whole thing seems so phony to you?" he said. "Yes." "It's like you're learning lines for a play?" "Yes, but it's like I'm at war with my own answers." "Because they're not exactly what you want to say, and you want to say more?" "Yes, Mr. President, yes, exactly." "Uh-huh. I've been there. Hence Denver." The president, of course, was referring to his awful performance in the first 2012 presidential debate. Although Mike was a genuinely nice guy, it's hard to run in a rough-and-tumble political race without getting annoyed with your opponent. I didn't remind him repeating ad infinitum that I had voted with President Obama 97% of the time, but man, he really hammered that talking point. At one point in a debate, after Mike had said it for the 8th time, I interrupted. "Excuse me, could you repeat that number again? Is it 97%? Let me write that down or I'll forget it, sure as shootin'." Frankly, the other thing that irked me most was one of his early web videos in which Mike spoke directly to the camera. A lot of people have asked me, why do I want to run for the U.S. Senate? Why do I want to put up with the attacks and insults, time away from my family. Yeah, why exactly was Mike running for the U.S. Senate? Oh, wait, I know. He was doing it because he wanted to be a United States senator. Let me tell you a little secret about United States senators. We all love being United States senators. We all like having a staff of brilliant young people whose work we can take credit for. We all like having reporters ask us for our insightful takes on crucial issues. We all love being called senator. You'll remember that in college, after deciding not to be a real scientist, I turned to a major in behavioral science, where I learned some valuable insights into what makes people tick. Take, for example, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. In 1943, Abraham Maslow formulated his influential hierarchy of needs theory to explain what motivates people. Usually these needs are depicted as a pyramid with five levels. The first two levels are considered basic needs. At the bottom are physiological needs: food, water, warmth, sleep. Next, safety needs, basically security. The next two levels are considered psychological needs. At level three, belongingness and love needs, intimate relationships and friends. Level four, esteem needs, feelings of accomplishment and prestige. In other words, being a U.S. senator. Or writing a theory of human motivation that everybody in psychology pays attention to. After achieving your physiological needs, levels one and two, and psychological needs, levels three and four, the very top of Maslow's pyramid goes to self-actualization, achieving one's full potential, including creative activities. For example, writing a book about being a U.S. senator. Every senator is different. Most of us are doing this to make a difference in people's lives. Most of us are also really into the self-aggrandizing part of the job. The balance between the two is different for everyone. Some of us are more noble than others. I like to think I'm in the top quintile. But we're all human beings. As a human being, I relished my 2014 victory as a vindication of all the good work my staff and I had done in the previous 5+ years. But the glow lasted about an hour. Pretty soon that night, my thoughts turned to worrying about a Republican-controlled Senate, our lagging economic recovery, kids living in poverty, global warming, the humanitarian tragedy in Syria, and the possibility that a real lunatic like Ted Cruz might win the Republican nomination in 2016. Thankfully, that didn't happen. Then I ate something, hugged my kids and my grandson Joe, and went to sleep in my warm bed with my wife of 39 years, thus fulfilling the first four levels on Maslow's hierarchy, which is a pretty lucky place to be.